Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. I am your host, Lauren Corman, here with tech Steve Romanin, co-producer, co-host as well. We have a really exciting show lined up, and I know we keep doing programs that I keep saying, I'm so excited about the show, but I really am just so thrilled that we are going to be speaking with Dr. Richard Twine about his new book, 2010, Animals as Biotechnology, Ethics, Sustainability, and Critical Animal Studies. I have not been so impressed by a book in a long time, and Richard is quickly becoming one of my favorite scholars, and I'm delighted that he'll be joining us on the program at about quarter after to talk about biotechnology and all of the implications. He's really done an incredibly impressive job of looking at a number of different fields. The scope of this book is amazing. He is bridging different debates within the scientific community, within philosophy, within his home discipline of sociology. And it's really an accessible text as well for people who want to weigh into this extremely important issue. So please stay tuned for the interview with Richard at about quarter after. But before we do that, we're going to hear some news with Steve Romanin, and we are also going to do our second feature, now an ongoing segment of the Animal Voices program. We are going to be hearing from Kevin Tillman with the Vegan Hip Hop Movement. Last week, we heard an excellent track that he had selected for us. Again, we're going to hear one of his selections, and he'll tell us about the track as well as the artist. So I know Steve is really excited to play this song on air.
Yeah, I listened to it last night and it's fantastic. Kevin outdid himself from last week.
I think that what will happen to hopefully our listeners as well as to Steve and I is that this will become the background music for your week. The song will be stuck in your head. So we're just so happy to have this segment now as a weekly part of the Animal Voices program to feature a song from the vegan hip hop movement. So we'll be doing that as well. But I think you're going to do your news first. Then we'll hear from Kevin, hear the song. Then we'll listen to some music, we'll come back, and we will have our interview with Richard Twine. Again, the book is called Animals as Biotechnology, Ethics, Sustainability, and Critical Animal Studies. I'm so stoked. Over to you, Steve.
I've got two articles this week. Once again, I wanted to put one sort of uplifting article and one threatening, I suppose. In this case, it's sort of bittersweet. I wanted to report about Prop B, which did pass. There was an interview we did a couple weeks ago with Barbara Schmitz, the director of the HSUS in Missouri, and she was the campaign manager for a legislative bill that was supposed to outlaw puppy mills, or greatly restrict them at least. And it did pass, but there is sort of a threat on the horizon. So I'll play our news here, and then we'll hear from Kevin.
Great.
Our first article comes to us from Kansas City News. Proposition B faces possible repeal effort. Voters passed Proposition B last week to protect puppies, but some state lawmakers are now discussing ways to possibly repeal the new initiative. The voters have spoken to this issue, said Barbara Schmitz, director of the Missouri Humane Society. Schmitz said she had seen firsthand the cruel treatment some breeders inflict on their dogs, from small wire cages to leaving them out in the extreme temperatures. Proposition B is meant to protect dogs from this kind of abuse. The laws were weak, she said. They were obsolete, and they simply weren't working. Proposition B passed by 61,000 votes, a slim 3.2% margin statewide. Residents in 100 of Missouri's 114 counties voted against it. Quote, "It lowers the standards Missouri already has, and we need to at least bring those standards back up to what they were," State Senator Bill Stouffer said. Stouffer, from Lafayette County, doesn't like the tougher restrictions on dog breeders, and thinks Prop B might be unconstitutional. Dogs are taxed as private property, and the state is not allowed to restrict one's property. He adds most breeders take good care of their dogs. The profit motive has breeders producing high-quality, healthy pups, he said. It's caused Missouri to be known as a puppy mill state, and it's embarrassing, said State Senator Joe Lee Justice from Kansas City. Justice said instead of trying to repeal Prop B, lawmakers need to fund tougher enforcement to make sure breeders don't own more than 50 female dogs, keep them in bigger cages, take them to the veterinarian each year, feed them at least once per day, and breed them no more than twice every 18 months. She said she fears the thought that the opposition might have the votes in January to overturn the new law. Quote, "There's a very, very, very strong lobby for folks who are dog breeders," Justice said. Most of the lawmakers in Jefferson City work in agriculture, and some of them fear Prop B might lead to tougher restrictions on other animals and livestock, even though it specifically only refers to dogs and cats. Our second article today comes to us from The Telegraph UK. Dolphins walk on water. Dolphins in the wild are teaching themselves to walk with their tails along the surface of the water, biologists have claimed. The mammals, which are celebrated for their playful natures, are developing the skill just for fun, according to the Whale and Dolphin Conservation Society in Australia. Dolphin tail walking has no known practical function and has been likened to dancing in humans. Whale and Dolphin Conservation Society researcher Dr. Mike Bosley, who has observed Adelaide Port River dolphins for the past 24 years, said he had documented spectacular tail walking in two adult female dolphins known as Billy and Wave. Now four other individuals have been recorded perfecting their walking techniques: Wave's calf Tallulah, Bianca, and her calves Hope and Bubbles. Tail walking is very rare in the wild, and in thousands of hours of observation, only one other dolphin has ever been observed tail walking in the Port River, and then only once. The Port Adelaide dolphins are now said to be tail walking many times each day. It is thought the mammals may have learned the remarkable skill from Billy, who spent a short period of time at a visitor attraction 22 years ago. Dr. Bosley said the spread of tail walking appeared to be motivated by fun, but it was also linked to a serious and fascinating cultural aspect previously unseen in the species. He said, quote, "Culture in the wider sense of the term, defined as learned behavioral characteristic of a community, is now frequently on show in the Port River. This cultural behavior is of great significance for conservation. Cultural behaviors in animals have been identified in several species, particularly chimpanzees. However, most, if not all, of the cultural behaviors described to date have been of a utilitarian nature, mainly to do with obtaining food. A well-known chimpanzee example is using a twig to extract termites from a nest in the Gombe Stream Reserve. The only dolphin example seen up till now is in Shark Bay, West Australia, where a small group of dolphins habitually carry a sponge on the end of their jaw while fishing to protect them from fish spines. As we are all aware, tail walking has no practical function and is performed just for fun, akin to humans dancing or gymnastics. As such, it represents an internationally important example of the behavioral similarities between humans and dolphins." And that's all of our news for today.
I'm stunned.
That second story, I was amazed. The sponge, especially, that's what really got me.
Mm-hmm. That's an incredible news piece.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. It harkens back to, you know, I mean, you interviewed Barbara Smuts, and I know that we've talked about her in your class, about this notion of animals having their own sort of
sociality and their own cultures, and
yeah, their own inventiveness too, I think. Mm-hmm. This really speaks to their inventiveness.
Yeah, and I think in particular the notion of play too. It's so outside of the kind of reductionistic way of people thinking about animals as sort of biological machines that are only driven by genetic wanting to propagate the species. Mm-hmm. Right, so those are excellent news pieces. Thanks so much. I should let people know there's a few additional announcements. People who had donated to the CIUT fundraising drive, we greatly appreciate your donation, and CIUT is asking us to remind folks to send in your donations if you actually haven't gotten it to the station yet. So they are asking you to do that, I think, before December the 3rd, mm-hmm. if you want to be entered in some of the CIUT draws as well. So thanks again, and also please do get your donation in. Neil, who is the third part of the Animal Voices crew here, and I guess we now get to include Kevin, which is really great. But Neil thought that it would be a good idea, too, for me to remind folks that not only do we have a website, animalvoices.ca, where you can check out any of our archive programs, but we also have a Facebook group, and we should be promoting that more. So please do befriend us, join the group on Facebook, and you can also find out more about the vegan hip-hop movement as well by going to Facebook and keying in the vegan hip-hop movement. You can write us at animalvoices@gmail.com. We always love to hear from listeners. Critiques, positive stuff, ideas for upcoming shows, it is all welcome. We're getting close to the quarter after point, but after we hear from Kevin Tillman from the Vegan Hip Hop Movement and his selection for the week, we're going to be speaking with Dr. Richard Twine about his new book, Animals as Biotechnology, Ethics, Sustainability, and Critical Animal Studies. It's an absolutely fantastic text. I'm really looking forward to hearing from Richard, but without further ado, I'll turn it over to Kevin Tillman from the Vegan Hip Hop Movement.
Hello, Animal Voices listeners. This is Kevin from the Vegan Hip Hop Movement with today's soundscape from John Graham, whose musical philosophy is mirror music, the manipulation of vibration created to reflect life's undeniable truths. Welcome to the musical mirror of songwriter and recording artist John Graham. Journey with him through sound and sight as he endeavors to bring balance back to music. And now here's his song, Absolute Power.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up as sisters and brothers gathered at the table of brotherhood.
You're talking about power, centralized power. And that power is being used against the people who are really producing the food, like the farmers. It's being used against the workers who work for these companies. And it's being used against consumers.
Yeah, what would you do if you were truly all-powerful? Use it properly or let the dark side devour you? Would you bring about the change to end the world's suffering? Or would you turn a blind eye and leave the people plundering? I'm wondering, would you be like Gandalf the Grey? Or would you play the part of Saruman and end the light of day? Man, they say absolute power corrupts absolutely. Be careful with the type of power that I'm introducing. If you could push a button and receive $1 million, but just by doing so you kill a father's only daughter, would you push it? Or would you feel a slight hesitation? Would you contemplate the consequence or think about vacation? If you could make the world a better place just by thinking it, simply blinking it would be utopia immediate. Would you be the greediest, the lustful, unappreciative, with hatred for the common man denying those who needed it? Would you be the one to take advantage of the destitute, lowering the price of junk and raise the price of vegetables? Would you wave your magic wand and put an end to gluttony, reverse the ill effects of obesity in this country? Would you tell the people what you're putting in the food supply? Would you keep it quiet, then encourage them to supersize? Would you lie to women and make them think it's impossible to have a child naturally instead of in a hospital? Lying on their backs while overdosing on Pitocin, they comatose the baby while the uterus is closing. If you could sign your name on the Treaty of Significance to end an occupation while freeing all the citizens, if you had the ears of the people and the masses and your grasp were in a class, would you lead or take advantage? Would you ask them to support you while you're rolling in a Bentley in return for guidance to their fairy tale ending? Would you help these little girls understand their prominence instead of falling for the first dude who gives them compliments? Would you praise the permanence of natural and encourage them, or tell them they're not beautiful unless they put a permanent? No, you're truly powerful. Remember that it's limitless. That means that you could speak it and the rest of us are living it. The rest of us would live with it. The best of us would have to unify on commonalities and overlook the differences. They say with great power comes great responsibility. The mantra is the movement. You should use it if you're feeling me. Since you have the power to tell me about what you can't do, can't you kill the word can't? Here's an example. You can make a conscious choice to only speak the positive. You can use the power of your voice to change a continent. You rewind this verse because I know you haven't gotten it. Your head's bobbing obvious. The beat has got you lost in it. I'm back to the future trying to save the clock tower. I'm mopping floors now, but with a focused willpower, I could be mayor. Yeah, that has a nice ring to it. On my Goldie Wilson end, this is just my theme music. This is Dr. King music. This is rapid eye movement. I have a dream music. Hope you never seen snoozing.
I have a dream that one day the glory of the Lord shall be revealed with this faith.
Rock inoculation meant to fortify immunity. Yes, you can see my power by the way that I'm influencing your local community. Cause everyone is usually moving like machines in a maze, chasing the moving cheese. The power's within you and me. Learn to use it fluently. What could the solution be? Honestly and truthfully, the question is the answer. They have the cure for cancer, yet they manufacture new disease. Google it and you will see. This is absolute power.
Hello and welcome back to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. That was a track that Kevin Tillman from the Vegan Hip Hop Movement selected for us. Every week on Animal Voices now, we will be hearing a special selection that Kevin has chosen for our listeners, specifically for the Animal Voices listeners. I want to say a big shout out to Kevin. Thank you so much for the description of the artist as well as the track. And with any luck, we'll be able to always include these tracks into the archive podcast as well. You can find this show within about a week archived on our website, animalvoices.ca. We are now turning to our very exciting interview with Dr. Richard Twine. We're speaking about his new book, Animals as Biotechnology, Ethics, Sustainability, and Critical Animal Studies. And just to give you a little bit more background on Richard, he is a researcher currently based in England, at Lancaster University's Department of Sociology and the Center for Economic and Social Aspects of Genomics. In 1996, he started the website www.ecofem.org, which is now a long-standing online presence for the dissemination of ecofeminism. In 2001, he finished his PhD on ecofeminist theory, and since 2004, his research has included a significant focus on the social and ethical dimensions of animal biotechnology. He credits this engagement with finally turning him vegan the same year. He also teaches gender studies at Lancaster University and is an active member of the Institute for Critical Animal Studies. It is my great pleasure to warmly welcome Richard to the program. Hi, Richard.
Hi.
How are you doing?
I'm good. It's great to talk to you.
It's wonderful to talk to you, too. I've been following your work for some time, and I feel like it's a natural pairing of what you've been trying to accomplish as a scholar, as an activist, and Animal Voices in the project that we've tried to do here over, since 1996. So it's really a great pleasure to have you on the show.
Yeah, good to be here.
So we're going to be focusing on your book, Animals as Biotechnology, Ethics, Sustainability, and Critical Animal Studies. This was very recently published by EarthScan, and there's so many different issues that you address. It's really a deeply intersectional and interdisciplinary text, which is something that you talk about at the beginning of the book. And I was wondering if we could actually start there, talk about some of the intersections, what that means that you're writing an intersectional text, and some of the disciplines and debates that you're focusing on in this work.
Sure. Yes, I do cover indeed a lot of different areas. And well, partly I'm influenced by intersectionality theory from feminist theory, which has been around at least for, I would say, over 20 years, formally, anyway. But then I'm also influenced by engagements with bioethics and sociological debates around the body, and I'm trying to apply those to non-human animals, and debates around the future direction of capitalism as well. So that's probably not even naming half of the intersections in the book, but that's a taster anyway.
And why this particular intervention? You focus on animal agriculture, its implications in terms of climate change, some of the debates around sustainability, and then the central question around biotechnology. Why this particular issue now?
I think that the issue has been neglected within sociology, within animal studies, within critical animal studies. There's not been much written on animal biotechnology really since the 90s, certainly in the way of books anyway. And well, one reason why we might want to turn to this issue right now is that it seems as if the moves to commercialize these technologies are certainly moving into gear. And also, I think the way in which animal biotechnologies are being advocated by some as potential answers to the problems of sustainability in light of fears over climate change means that now is a particularly good issue to think critically about these potential developments.
Okay, so let's step back a little bit then and talk about what is actually implied when we talk about animal biotechnology. What does that mean?
That itself is a contested question, and certainly some adherents of animal biotechnology would just want to simply argue that the selective breeding of animals that we've been doing for a long time should just be seen as a form of biotechnology. But usually in a more technical sense, biotechnology refers to using the knowledge accrued from sequencing the genomes of animal species that we tend to farm. And so, for example, since the turn of the century, there have been ongoing efforts to sequence the genomes of popularly farmed agricultural species, such as the chicken, bovine, and so on. And so I define biotechnology to refer to these particular molecular techniques, such as using genomic knowledge to achieve what scientists refer to as a more accurate and precise selection. So these techniques are termed things like marker-assisted selection, and more recently the term genomic selection, and then more invasive, we might say, techniques such as genetic modification, but also cloning would come in there as well.
And on the one hand, it seems like there is this marketing of these sets of technologies as being, I think you talk about in one part of the book, this win-win idea that everybody can kind of benefit. Look, we help the environment, we make a more benign environmental intervention when we use these modified animals or their genomes modified in some ways. That's good, and we can make better, healthier products for people, and which is the common discourse of the agricultural industry, is to say, and all this also improves animal welfare. So all of it sounds pretty good. And then as I'm reading through the book, the word that keeps coming to mind to me is that I think Vandana Shiva talks about it as like the most intimate form of colonization, the colonization of the gene. And to kind of lay that reading against this notion that everybody wins, everybody can benefit from this, those two things seem to collide.
Yeah, well, the idea of winning in that sense is, of course, dependent on a quite specific and some would say shallow notion of animal ethics in terms of a particular understanding of what welfare means. And the term win-win is something that I found when I was, as part of the research for the book, interviewing animal scientists. And this was a recurrent phrase that they would use, that if we can manipulate the genome to make the agricultural industry more productive, yet at the same time do things like improve animal welfare and the environmental impact of animal agriculture, then that is exactly the phrase they use. But you're exactly, I think I like the way that you put that in terms of a kind of very intimate intervention of actually changing the genetics of a species, or at least changing the way in which we can select. That might not include sort of adding or subtracting genes. It might just mean a more precise selection. But one of the things that I was particularly interested in communicating with the book was a moral point, really, that this aspect, I suppose, of the animal industrial complex, the genetics, the varied fields of animal science, which are crucial to kind of securing the profitability of the industry, are not really that well known, I don't think, amongst the typical consumer of these products. And I think, as we know, that the animal industrial complex is something that which operates through concealment and relies on people not knowing various dimensions of it. And so I saw a value in writing about these sciences of animal breeding, be they biotechnology or be they just other sciences related to animal nutrition or something like that, because they're just, I don't think that they're appreciated, the effort of planning and the public funding of these sciences and so on and so forth.
I realize that for people who are maybe just thinking about these topics for the first time, that it can sound like a lot of abstraction. And certainly I was overwhelmed reading the book at times by the kind of language that's used and some of the acronyms to weigh into some of the scientific debates. It's easy to get lost in some of the scientific jargon. So I was wondering if you can give us maybe a few concrete examples about what animal biotechnology looks like now, and what are the implications for the animals themselves, for the environment, for human health, in terms of your interpretation of those technologies?
Well, in terms of something like GM and cloning, I mean, it's a varied picture, because it seems that there's quite a difference between the regulatory environment in, say, Europe and that within, for example, the US. And the United States Food and Drug Administration is currently holding public meetings around the issue of genetically engineered Atlantic salmon, for example. And that's been an ongoing story for the last 14 years, with a company called Aqua Bounty, which has been trying to get their genetically engineered salmon commercialized. And it looks like it actually might be commercialized quite soon. And it's a similar story with cloning, that in the United States, there's certainly been regulatory moves in the past few years which have argued that cloned animals are essentially the same as non-cloned animals in various respects. But one of my critiques is that the regulatory procedure has tended to be conducted in terms of assessing the safety of the product to human consumption, rather than thinking about what's implied by your question, the actual experience of the animal and the ethical dimensions of rearing these animals. So it's difficult to provide an assessment of what is about to happen, and it is definitely a varied picture. But certainly there is a lot of research ongoing on GM and cloning, but also a technique called genomic selection, which is essentially, it's quite difficult to explain, but it's using the map genome to produce a more accurate, a more precise selection of particular traits that might not necessarily have been so easy to select for in the past. In terms of the impact on animals themselves, it's probably not that much different in terms of things like genomic selection, it's probably not that much different experientially, one could argue, to the experiences of animals at the moment. I mean, that is another argument in the book, that it's a mistake to sort of put all the moral anxiety onto biotechnology when certainly selective breeding in the context of industrialized agriculture has more than enough moral issues mm-hmm. to sink one's teeth into as it stands.
We have to take a short break, do a station ID, and then we will come back and talk more about your book, Animals as Biotechnology, Ethics, Sustainability, and Critical Animal Studies. Please stay tuned. Hello and welcome back to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5. Today we're speaking with Dr. Richard Twine about his book, Animals as Biotechnology, Ethics, Sustainability, and Critical Animal Studies. And I wanted to pick up on this notion of anxiety that we just touched on before the short break. And I'm wondering, Richard, why we should be concerned. How would you articulate that to general public, maybe doesn't know very much about biotechnology? Why should we engage with this issue?
Well, I think the common way in which this is often communicated is that we should be concerned because these products might not be safe to eat or something. But I want to sort of get beyond that frame, which I think is sort of quite human-centered. And I would argue that, there are two main reasons for concern specifically around producing animals as biotechnology. And that is, firstly, that I argue that these techniques lock in, kind of embed a particular and strengthen, I guess, an instrumental view of animals and bring us further along a particular trajectory which views animals as mechanical objects which we don't need to think about our particular treatment of. And so it's not only that in industrialized farming that the farm has become a factory, but it's now within biotechnological approaches that the body of the animal itself is similarly viewed as a factory which can be manipulated for producing new forms of capitalizable products, be that food products or also medicine products in the case of using animal bodies to produce drugs. And the second reason really is that this is a novel power. It's a power that we've not had ever before to manipulate animals, and this is something that we should reflect upon collectively as a species and really think, what does that mean? What does that actually do to our own self-perception as a species, to think that we're actually deepening the way and increasing the power that we have over other animals, and what that might say about what we are, how that changes human identity, and also what might be the implications of such a move for our relationship with other animals, but also how these technologies might be disguising particular elements of our actions and perhaps just being used to prevent us from considering changes to our behavior.
Mm. Well, I mean, one of the things that's so clear about what you're doing in the book is that you're paying very close attention to various different discourses, how people think about, talk about, frame, position animals and various different other actors in these debates. So there's real kind of paying attention to those sorts of gaps, who's silenced. But then there's also a similar critique that you are waging against sort of the material reality of the situation and what this means, and with a very pointed critique of capitalism and the kind of leveraging of capitalism that is really the prime motivating force behind a lot of this. And so kind of combine those two sets of analyses together. And one of the things that I find is, because it's a very powerful set of analyses that you do in the book, is that I think it's easy, and you don't go this route, but it would be easy just to feel that there's too much invested economically there to really begin to confront in any kind of meaningful way a real challenge to the problematics of those kinds of technology. And you talk about there's particular policy implications and advocacy implications, because I think that's important, especially when people think about, okay, we need to have a discussion about that. And clearly the public dialogue is important, and a critical public dialogue and a kind of confronting of these discourses. But what would this actually mean in terms of creating real change for animals and various others that are impacted by these technologies?
I guess that's a long question.
Yeah, sorry.
One of my arguments is that given that we can note within animal science research projects an attempt to use molecular knowledge, i.e. biotechnology, to bypass some of the major societal critiques of animal agriculture by attempting to change the actual body of the farmed animal. And so obviously these major critiques are things like, you know, the climate change impact of meat consumption and production, the impact on public health and the impact to animal welfare. And so the idea is that we can breed animals that emit less methane, that have a lower fat content, and in some way, for example, in terms of an animal welfare example, breed animals which are less aggressive or something. You know, there might be a good reason why they become aggressive in the first place, of course. And so this particular approach is, if we can contextualize that within a particular mode of capitalism, and I particularly talk about the knowledge economy sort of idea of capitalism, that this approach sort of protects patterns of consumption, and it's a kind of business as usual approach, and we don't actually have to reflect upon the consumption. We don't have to sort of think about reducing our consumption, or even, you know, it's not radical to probably the listeners of this program, but, you know, actually not having to subsist on meat or dairy products at all.
I think that, of course, and I mean, this is hopefully what the radio show is trying to do, and what the book does is to help to prompt public dialogue and a kind of critical thinking around some of the technologies. But I'm wondering about sort of the practical implications in terms of policy, which is something that you pay attention to in the book, as well as advocacy implications for this.
Well, I note towards the end of the book that we have sort of seen in the past 2 to 3 years an emerging idea of meat reduction with all these campaigns like Meat Free Mondays and so on, and quite major policy players involved in climate change policy arguing for either meat reduction, but also occasionally arguing for vegetarianism, probably not as far as veganism, but given the impact of the dairy industry on climate change, I think that's a pretty clear argument as well. But on the other hand, in terms of advocacy, I sort of then at that point put my sort of sociologist hat on and say it's kind of simplistic in a sense just to simply call for meat reduction or for people to quite quickly become vegetarian or vegan, because the way in which our eating practices are enmeshed within particular identities, and it's not just a simple straightforward act, and that there are other things which are sort of sustaining these ways in which we relate to other animals. And of course the major example, I suppose, of that would be the sort of literature which would, for example, argue that there's a link between masculinity and eating meat and that sort of thing. But there's so many other examples. For example, you know, family traditions, regional traditions, religious traditions, which have locked people into particular human-animal relations. And it is, you know, a very simplistic thing to try to just advocate for that change without also reflecting upon these sociological dimensions of eating practices.
So where, if we read this book as animal advocates, where would we go in terms of trying to do that more complicated thinking, and then what would that mean in terms of how we do our activism?
I think this is a challenge. I mean, this is what I would call intersectional thinking, that animal advocates can't just be animal advocates. They have to also think about how human-animal relations are also a part of gender relations. They're also a part of ideas of nation and investments within particular religious ideas. It doesn't make for a simple advocacy message, unfortunately, but it does mean that we have to be very reflective on things that we call for, and to reflect on sometimes people argue that the environmental movement or vegetarian or vegan movement is quite a sort of middle class movement, and so that is something that I think is really important to reflect upon. And so you target your advocacy in such a way that can perhaps simultaneously take on more than just the animal issue. So you target your advocacy in such a way to overlap, for example, class and human-animal relations, or class and gender, or class and race, and so on.
One of the things that really impressed me about your approach was that as part of your methodology, you did interviews, you dialogued with scientists who are involved with animal biotechnology, and you attended various different conferences that would not be considered critical animal studies conferences. These are conferences that are deeply invested in particular scientific and economic worldviews in relationship to animals and the environment and other people. And I was wondering about some of your insights that you drew from this dialogue with scientists. I think that's work that I would like to see more of in critical animal studies, this kind of direct engagement with those in positions of power, those that are informing this debate and certainly the direction of these technologies.
Well, I mean, one of the subfields of sociology which I'm involved with is known as science studies, which is essentially sociologists studying scientists. And so one of the methods within that subfield of sociology is to go into the space of scientists and to listen to the way in which they talk about the world and describe the world. And so, yeah, there was something that I think I had to do and also wanted to do because I wanted to try to understand how animal scientists, and within that term animal scientists, there's quite a diversity. I mean, there are animal welfare scientists, there are animal genetic scientists, and a lot of variation within that, and also quite a variation of moral approaches to human-animal relations. So, for example, within animal welfare science, certainly there's a different way of thinking about animals compared to, in general terms, people doing animal genetic science, which is, I guess, quite a reductive, quite about manipulating the genomes and sort of seeing the animal in terms of its genetics rather than its lived reality. But yeah, I think it's an important thing to do. It's a difficult thing to do, I think, for somebody who's also in animal studies and critical animal studies, because it means spending a lot of time with people who you might find quite different to yourself in terms of how they see the world. But I think that's an important part of research anyway.
What are some of the things that strike you about some of those conversations that you had?
Some of the ways in which, for example, the geneticists would speak about welfare and as a kind of a luxury thing, really, I suppose. But even that welfare that they were talking about would be quite a minimum sort of definition of welfare. And I think really that the politics within the field of animal science itself really interesting, because in general terms, it's the geneticists who are getting more of the research money, and it's animal welfare scientists who feel marginalized by other branches of animal science. So I think that really struck in my mind. And even just sort of interviewing animal scientists who were sharing the same corridor within the same research center, and yet were having completely different views on human-animal relations. So there'd be, for example, a vegetarian animal welfare scientist, and then maybe just further down the corridor there'd be a geneticist who was all about increasing the productivity of the animal body. And really just that always sort of stuck in my mind, the difference there within the same sort of space, and the difficulty that there must be for animal welfare scientists who pretty much have to adopt quite a pragmatic approach to their work to try to achieve any small change to the experiences of farmed animals.
We're down to about the last 10 minutes. It really went quickly. I wanted to turn it over to you. I know that you you teach at university. You're used to sort of lecture mode, and I'm wondering if I could maybe get you to shift gears into that mode, because I'm worried that I'm not going to be addressing the things that maybe you feel are most important that you want to highlight from the book. So I'm going to just turn it over to you, actually, for the next 10 minutes, if you want to just talk about the book and some of the things maybe that we haven't touched on that you think are relevant that you'd like to share with our listeners.
Okay, thanks. Well, I think we have covered quite a lot of some of the main issues. But I suppose one of the sort of interesting questions that we could discuss is the way in which, I guess, animal advocates have turned to climate change, really, as a kind of campaigning crutch in which to base their campaigning on. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an interesting move, and I think some people have been critical of that because it's sort of seen as not purely about animal ethics, but rather about environmental issues, and those environmental issues might actually be more about the survival of the human race, which is, you know, still a cause dear to my heart. But I think there might be some feeling amongst advocates that move to climate change might not necessarily be seen as a animal ethics or an animal liberation issue. Mm. So what I would want to probably emphasize in that is that the sort of long-standing schisms between environmental politics and animal politics really need to be healed and brought together, and that this is a very sort of false distinction which still perpetuates I see it a lot in particular environmental movements for sustainability, which define sustainability. It somehow managed to define sustainability as not including human-animal relations. So there is this tension. But in terms of talking about climate change, it's obviously, to me anyway, an animal liberation issue, because it's going to affect all animals, human and non-human, and that will be in the sense of changing our habitats and loss of biodiversity and threats of species extinction as well. So I think it's important probably for animal advocates to, when they take on the sort of climate change argument, to stress that they are arguing for non-human and human-animal issues.
Okay, can you just link that with then the conversation around biotechnology? What does that? Why would we be talking about climate change when we're talking about biotechnology, animals, and biotechnology?
Yeah. Just really that biotechnology is being advocated by its adherents that it can be one technique to mitigate climate change. If, for example, as we see various arguments, for example, that the oft-quoted FAO 18% figure of animal agriculture globally contributing 18% to greenhouse gases, and then biotechnology being put forward as something which can stem that figure and to bring it down by producing animals which are somehow more environmentally benign. So that, I mean, that's the main, probably the main connection within biotechnology. But that is a very what we would call promissory sort of claim. It's not fulfilled. It's a little bit of what scientists tend to do is to promise a particular measure that they can take, but it's then a kind of gap between the research and the actual outcome being delivered. So then the major kind of contradiction then is between the livestock revolution and the impact of animal agriculture on greenhouse gases. So if your listeners don't know, the livestock revolution, which is already underway, it's the increasing meat and dairy consumption around the world, especially in developing countries. Our rate of consumption is forecast to double by 2050. And yet, if that same consumption is contributing 18% of greenhouse gases, then that's simply not sustainable to double that degree of consumption. So I guess that's where these debates around biotechnology fit into these tensions between environmentalism and animal advocacy, which I think environmentalists really need to stop defining sustainability as something which can exclude human-animal mm-hmm. relations. It's a strange sort of environment that doesn't include animals, don't you think?
One of the arguments that you make in the book, and of course I'm paraphrasing here, but that some of the problematic ways of thinking about the environment and about animals have given rise to climate change, and it's that same thinking that informs now these technological fixes that are proposed. It's the very ideologies that got us into this set of complicated and deeply concerning problems that are now being trying to be leveraged in order to get us out of those same problems.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
If you have anything else that you wanted to share, you talked about climate change, and if there's anything else you wanted to touch on before we go, or a particular website that you'd like to plug, anything that you'd like to say in the last five.
I think the other thing, I mean, when someone sees a book about animals and biotechnology, they might think it's also about medical research as well. And it's probably worth saying that it's actually, my focus is on agriculture, but I also make the argument that we can't actually make that neat sort of split between medicine and agriculture. So we can't make that neat split between what is going on in terms of research around animal biotechnology in these two domains. Because what I found in the course of my research is that those doing medical research on animals and using sort of molecular knowledge in that process are also sort of transferring their findings to the agricultural domain, and those scientists working in the agricultural domain are also transferring their knowledge back over to the medical domain. So that's sort of quite an interesting finding that is worth dwelling on, because it also means that you sort of discover these strange things like, well, the human genome, information gleaned from the human genome, is also proving valuable to agricultural scientists, which means that knowledge from the human genome is being used in meat production, which is sort of quite interesting from a moral viewpoint. Mm. So I think, yeah, that's a further important message to emphasize, that scientists themselves don't necessarily make these distinctions between medicine and agriculture. And so it's probably good from a general public interest perspective, but also from an advocacy perspective, to appreciate that these domains could be seen as converging, although there has been sort of a history that predates genomics anyway, that has sort of transferred knowledge between these two areas.
I'm going to ask a completely unfair last question as we go. That's out. Fine. I know that we have just a couple more minutes, and we're going to be playing some music too as we go out. But mm-hmm. I'm wondering, Richard, about what brings you hope right now in terms of this issue, or in terms of some of the developments in the field of critical animal studies or in sociology, etc. Like, what's keeping you at this work?
Yes. Well, I suppose like the world generally at the moment, there's a lot of glum messages around. I suppose what gives me hope really is that people are beginning to see, and this might sound like a strange thing to say, but they're beginning to see the idea of the human itself as something which is not necessarily set in stone. You know, people take recourse to ideas of human nature, and this is how we have to act because that's the way the human is. But I think gradually we can see that idea being sort of chiseled away, and we can see a certain openness in what it means to be human. And we can see this in people moving away from meat and dairy consumption in increasing numbers. And so that's probably what gives me hope, that more and more people, I think, are becoming vegan, and that this is redefining what it means to be human in ways that people won't like, but there are important ways that challenge particular ideas of what it has meant up until this historical moment in terms of what people have understood what it means to be a human being.
Thank you so much for being on the show, Richard.
Thank you.
I hope that you'll come back. We'd love to continue the conversation.
Okay, thanks very much, Lauren.
Bye for now.
Okay, bye.
We were just speaking with Richard Twine. He is the author of a new book. Very highly recommend this text, called Animals as Biotechnology, Ethics, Sustainability, and Critical Animal Studies. Thanks to Steve Roman, and thanks to Kevin Tillman for helping put together this show. And we have Raw Sugar coming up on CIUT 89.5 FM.